Min Condition by Anna Moyo. Philip N. Deal makes change, literally. As director of the United States Mint, he and his colleagues produced roughly 20 billion circulating coins per year, those nickels, dimes, and quarters that jingle in your pockets and feed parking meters. They also manufacture and sell collectibles, commemoratives, and bullion coins. With annual revenues of $2.5 billion a year, 2,200 employees, and 4 manufacturing plants, the Mint makes money by making money. More important, Philip Deal knows how to make change. Deep-seated, far-reaching, this feels like a different place kind of change. When he took charge of the Mint in September 1994, the agency lived up to every negative stereotype of a government bureaucracy. It was inefficient, slow-moving, and utterly clueless about the standards of performance in the business world. One telling example, the Mint's primary responsibility is to keep an adequate supply of coins in circulation on behalf of its main customer, the Federal Reserve System. But 6 years ago, no one at the Mint could tell you how many coins were in its inventory. Not that many Mint officials thought it was a big problem. Philip Deal remembers his first visit to agency's headquarters, shortly after he was appointed by President Clinton. "I got to the building a little after 5 p.m., and the hallways were empty. There wasn't a person in sight. I actually called my wife and told her that there must be a bomb scare, but there wasn't. It was just business as usual at this sleepy, 201-year-old government agency that had lost its passion." Today, the Mint is exploring every stereotype of a government agency and exploiting it. It is setting a standard for performance and improvement that would be the envy of most private companies. Are you trying to improve customer relations? According to the influential American Customer Satisfaction Index, the Mint now ranks second only to Mercedes-Benz North America in customer satisfaction. Are you trying to recreate new lines of business from your existing people and assets? The Mint is turning its police force, the folks who, among other responsibilities, guard Fort Knox, into a revenue-generating unit that sells its services to other federal agencies and to governments. It has also launched a new product line, the heralded 50 State Quarters program that is attracting a new generation of young collectors. What's more, the Mint has gone .com in a big way, using the web to generate customer feedback on its coin designs and taking the eBay approach to sell collectibles online. "We've fundamentally changed people's expectations of our performance," Deal declares with obvious satisfaction. "We've changed the expectations of our stakeholders on Capitol Hill. We've changed the expectations of our employees in terms of how they're treated. And we've changed our customers' expectations of our performance. In the old days, we shipped fewer than 50% of our orders within 8 weeks. Today, if it takes 2 weeks for customers to receive an order, they complain. When you change expectations, it's very hard for an organization to relax and slip back into old patterns of behavior." Deal, 48, whose nearly 6-year tenure is drawing to a close, believes that the Mint's transformation is comparable to some of the better-known change programs in a private sector. "It's hard to argue with his assessment. I was sitting with my staff yesterday at a meeting," he says. "I was listening to my director of marketing describe the huge demand for our products and all the things we're doing on the web. We've had 3 straight weeks of million-dollar sales on the web, and I fully expect that we'll soon have our first million-dollar day. I told the folks who are around the table, if this were a company, a bunch of you would be IPO millionaires, just based on what we've done over the past 6 months. And that's the remarkable thing about what's happened. People have achieved this huge turnaround without any of the traditional incentives that companies use. Folks here get modest bonuses and free jackets. They're not doing it for the money." Change customers' expectations. Philip Deal cuts an imposing figure. He's tall, with a full head of jet black hair, confident voice, and a slight Texas twang. He arrived at the Mint with an impressive background, former chief of staff of the Senate Finance Committee and Lloyd Benston's first chief of staff during Benston's tenure as Secretary of the Treasury. In other words, Deal could have spent his early days as the director of Mint making bold declarations, big promises, perhaps even dire threats. But as a change agent who is in it for the long term, he chose another path. "I've always been in a hurry," he said. It's sort of my personal style. But I didn't rush the changes at the Mint. I started small, with a few initiatives here and there. Then as the envelope was pushed, or as roadblocks appeared, problems were tackled as they cropped up and progress continued. Big changes have been made over the past 6 years, but they've been made incrementally. You do big things by doing lots of small things. Back in 1994, Deal and his change-minded Mint colleagues could have taken their first small steps in just about any direction. Costs needed to be cut. Manufacturing plants needed to be streamlined. But Deal's first crucial decision was to focus on changes that got to the heart of the Mint's relationship with its customers. "One of the greatest lessons I've learned," he says, "is that if you identify a problem that customers really care about and then commit yourself to publicly fixing it, taking that risk is absolutely crucial to changing an organization. And if you can fix the problem, you build an incredible sense of confidence that the organization can tackle the next problem." The customer service problems that needed to be fixed were plentiful, especially on the collectibles side. Sure, the Mint manufactures dimes and quarters, guards the gold in Fort Knox, but it also runs a huge mail order business, a government version of L.L. Bean or Land's End, with distributors in 45 countries that sells coins to more than 1.1 million collectors. Last year, that business alone generated revenue of more than $1 billion. But the collectibles and commemoratives operation was big despite the Mint, not because of it. Its customer service center in Lanham, Maryland was something out of Charles Dickens rather than Tom Peters. The center sat on the first floor of a converted warehouse. Customer service reps were packed into a dismal space where the heat didn't work in the winter and air conditioning failed in the summer. "It was god-awful," says Deal. To make matters worse, the center was housed in the same building as a U.S. Postal Service regional package handling facility. Anytime postal workers stumbled on a strange-looking package, they'd issue a bomb scare, and the entire building would be evacuated. As a result, it wasn't all that unusual for an incoming call to be answered not by a U.S. Mint customer service rep, no matter how frostbitten or heat-exhausted, but by an answering machine. This dysfunctional environment produced depressing results. The Mint was fulfilling only half of its mail orders within 8 weeks. The rest, jokes Kevin Cullinane, 48, assistant director for customer care, would take anywhere from 8 weeks to infinity. "That type of performance would bankrupt a private company," says Cullinane. But as a government agency, the Mint simply ignored the reality of its performance. "There was no sense of urgency about the problem," says Deal, "or even a sense that there was a problem." The situation got worse. One reason that the Mint didn't feel a sense of urgency about its frayed relationships with customers was that it was basically forbidden from interacting with them. Prior to the Clinton administration, the Office of Management and Budget actively discouraged agencies from spending money on focus groups and surveys, the most rudimentary tools used by private companies to gauge their performance. "OMB never saw the benefit of having an agency talk to its customers," Deal says, half seriously. "In fact, it's suspected that if you were talking with them, you were conspiring with them to get Congress to do something that OMB didn't want done." That paranoid mindset created a bureaucratic maze in which every customer survey instrument that the Mint wanted to use had to be approved by OMB, a review process that took, on average, 6 months. So Diehl hit on a simple idea. If the Mint couldn't serve its customers officially, Diehl himself would do so unofficially. A few weeks after joining the Mint, he embarked on his own personal fact-finding mission. He went to coin conventions, talked with the hobby press, found situations in which he could interact with collectors. He shunned the ceremonial role the director of the Mint usually plays at these functions. Collectors would line up to ask for Diehl's autograph, and did what any smart politician and change agent would do. He worked the room. Diehl asks questions, he listened, and he learned. He quickly identified the two most widely shared complaints about how the Mint did business. One, it took too long to get coins into its customers' hands. Two, because the Mint required payment up front, it was holding on to its customers' money for an unreasonably long time. So Diehl and his colleagues got to work. Task force was formed to work on the two issues. 3 months later, the group had made some progress. But Diehl knew that it would take more heat to get the fires going. "We had to put our reputation on the line," he said. He went public with his customer service agenda. To a very active hobby press, general media, and a nervous Mint staff, Diehl promised that from then on, the Mint would process 95% of its orders within 6 weeks. That was far from Diehl's ultimate goal, but it was a big improvement over existing performance. His gambit worked. The sense of urgency increased, and the sense of accountability to external customers kept the pressure up. "Our task force figured out how to meet the 6-week goal," Diehl says. Then it set a standard for processing 95% of all orders within 4 weeks. Over the past 5 years, we've tightened the standard several more times. Today, we are delivering 95% of our products within 2 weeks, and we're delivering some products within one. Those tangible achievements touched off a wave of customer service improvements at the Mint. Incoming calls to the new customer service center, located only 4 miles, but a world away from the old facility in Lanham, got answered on average in 17.5 seconds rather than in 2 minutes. Letters about problems or complaints get handled within 3 days rather than the 42 days it took 3 years ago. Returns or credits get issued in 3 days versus 31. 5 years ago, says Cullinane, most people at the Mint, and especially the people in customer service, believed that their job was to protect the assets of the U.S. government. "Before we send you your coins, we're going to make sure that your check clears, that your credit is good. We really believe the customers were trying to defraud the government or take advantage of us. Today, we have gone to the other extreme. Customer is right. Customer is king. We want our service to rank with the best in the business." It does. A few years into Diehl's tenure, the Mint, along with several other agencies, got permission to be part of the American Customer Satisfaction Index, an annual poll conducted by the National Quality Research Center at the University of Michigan Business School. Talk about a turnaround. The Mint received the best scores of any agency included in the study. But based on its scores, the Mint would have ranked second in service among the 200 private sector companies in the poll, just behind Mercedes-Benz North America and tied with H.J. Heinz. Kevin Cullinane feels the changes personally. "The interest in our products is just phenomenal," he said. "A few years ago, if I went to a party and said I worked at the Mint, someone might say, 'How about those dollar bills?' When, of course, we make coins. Today, when I tell someone I'm from the Mint, you can see the excitement. 'What's happening with those new quarters? I love the one from New Jersey.'" Change how you think about change. The first wave of change at the Mint was impressive, but inadequate. It was certainly better to answer a customer call in 17 seconds than in 2 minutes. But it was better to deliver orders in 2 weeks rather than in 8 weeks. But the challenges at the Mint ran deeper than what such technocratic fixes could solve. There were fundamental problems with strategy, marketing, and even how the agency defined the business it was in. Put simply, the Mint had an identity crisis. Was it, essentially, a passive manufacturing organization that responded to the demands of Congress and the Federal Reserve? Or was it a market-driven organization that could launch product campaigns and innovations, introduce new promotional campaigns, and change the game in a business that it had been in for 200 years? The Mint needed a new story to move it into the future, says Deal. So the story of the Mint was retold, starting with its founding by Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. The story reminded people that Mint was on the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution as one of the first manufacturing companies in the United States. Telling that story helped to create a new spirit among the staff. It got us further out of our bunker mentality. As the leadership of the Mint thought more deeply about the agency's identity and future, one of its first insights was that its product offerings were flawed, especially when it came to collectibles and commemoratives. For one thing, it was selling too many of them. 5 or 6 times a year, Congress would come up with an idea for a commemorative coin to raise money for a pet cause. But these programs, based more on political calculations than on market demand, were highly unpopular with collectors. It got so bad that in 1995, the coin collecting community actually threatened to boycott the Atlanta Centennial Olympic Commemorative, which would be competing with 5 other commemoratives in circulation. Scarcity drives collectibles, says Deal. But we were becoming the coin of the month club. So he and his crew marched to Capitol Hill to convince Congress to limit its commemorative coin, fixed 2 per year. We had finally committed to representing the interests of our collectors, says Deal. And we demonstrated that we were prepared to defend those interests. Reducing an oversupply of bad coins simply inspired the next challenge, creating a more robust market for good coins. The fact was, congressional meddling aside, most of the Mint's coins weren't very compelling. Themes weren't interesting. The designs, which almost never changed, weren't engaging. But that hadn't always been the case. Back in the 19th century, coin designs were ambitious, and they did change frequently, which is why collecting had become so popular. But in the 20th century, once the Mint began putting dead presidents on coins, it became virtually impossible to take them off. Ask Steele, who's going to propose removing George Washington from the quarter? Still, Deal and his crew understood that unless they changed how the Mint made its change, their ability to make lasting change at the Mint would be limited. Enter marketing director David Pickens. Pickens, 53, loves coins. He's been a coin collector off and on since he was 8 years old. It was this early love of coins that gave Pickens a sense of what the Mint's future might hold. I realized that the Mint could use its heritage and legacy to make change, says Pickens, whose official title is Associate Director for Numismatics. There aren't many organizations that can manufacture to the Mint's quality levels. Have you heard the term mint condition? Well, this is the Mint. Yet it has suffered from a lack of strategic imagination and from the stealth marketing that was done. The Mint produces a legacy product that people will be collecting through the next several millennia, Pickens continues. There's a mystique to this type of permanence. A coin has the year on it. It has In God We Trust on it. It's sculpture, art, history. It's representation of our culture and our civilization. Most of our customers buy our coins and never intend to sell them. They pass them on to their children or their children's children. The more that Deal and Pickens thought about the Mint's long-term strategy, the more they rethought the nature of the business itself. They realized that the Mint wasn't just in the business of selling collectibles. It was also in the business of creating and fostering exchanges. Exchanges between fathers and sons, between brothers and sisters, between perfect strangers. Coin collectors have always known that coins have 2 functions in society, explains Deal. Primarily, coins facilitate commerce. But more important, coinage has always been used to tell the story of our nation to its own people, to itself. Only by understanding how customers viewed coinage could we rediscover a crucial method of using coins to tell our own story. Adds Pickens. We had forgotten the magic in our product. People were bored with coins. We had failed to see what it was that made coining and coin collecting exciting. Thus began one of the most successful consumer product launches of the 1990s. The Mint's 50 State Quarters program, unveiled in December 1998, is a long-term initiative designed to rejuvenate public interest in coins. The program honors each state with its own special quarter. It involves the public, through the governor's office of each state, in the design process. Every 10 weeks for 10 years, a new state quarter gets put into circulation, released in the order in which each state joined the Union. First Delaware, then Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Georgia, and so on. Like most of the changes at the Mint, the initial push for the state quarters program came from collectors. For years, they'd urged the Mint to reintroduce circulating commemorative pocket change. But Diehl had been very skeptical. His early years at the Mint were tough ones. Even as he was making big changes in Washington, the Mint's manufacturing operations were struggling to make enough coins. Diehl had neither the funding flexibility nor the personal desire to stimulate additional demand. Over time, though, as he sensed the enthusiasm coming from the collectors, he realized that the idea was too good a business opportunity to pass up. Of course, even a well-designed product needs a well-defined marketing strategy, competency that the Mint had never developed. How would it tell the public, especially kids, most of whom were interested more in Pokemon cards than in coins, about this revolutionary new product? Answer: Kermit the Frog. We were looking for the right person to introduce the program, and he volunteered, jokes Pickens. In fact, the Jim Henson Company contacted the Mint after it got wind of the program, and an unprecedented public-private marketing alliance was formed. Kermit, the official Mint spokesfrog, took the agency prime time, promoting the 50 State Quarters program in commercial spots during shows like NYPD Blue and Jeopardy, and on such cable TV channels as Nickelodeon, Lifetime, Discovery, and the History Channel. The results have been stunning. How many companies have introduced a product that will sell more than 4 billion units in its first year and will be touched by every person in this country? Asked Steele. When you think of it in those terms, this program is huge. Even if you only think of it in profit terms, it's huge. Huge indeed. It costs the Mint about 5 cents to make a quarter. It sells the quarter through the Federal Reserve Bank at face value. Translation: the Mint makes an 80% margin on every sale of every quarter. The baseline demand for quarters averages 1.5 billion a year. By the end of 1999, the Mint expects to have produced a total of 3.5 billion quarters, 2 billion above baseline demand. That's real money. But profit isn't the primary objective. It would be disappointing if, at the end of this 10-year program, all we have to show are 10 enormously profitable years, says Diehl. Our underlying goal is to rejuvenate coin collecting by getting the interest of a new generation of coin collectors. But the long-term effects will involve more than money. The 50 State Quarters program has refocused the Mint on the overall collectibles market, and the explosion of web-based auction sites, eBay, Auction.com, Amazon.com, and others, is helping a fast-growing activity to grow even faster. In fact, 24% of all coins purchased by collectors are bought online. Diehl and Pickens quickly realized that to maintain the agency's momentum, the Mint would have to .com itself. There aren't many companies founded by Thomas Jefferson that are selling products on the internet, notes Pickens. This now 207-year-old government agency would have to embrace e-commerce. My vision for the future doesn't have much to do with the mint's products, markets, performance measures, or efficiency, Diehl says. It has to do with the relationship that people have here with their work. My goal is to be part of an organization whose members are engaged as whole people. I want them to have a sense of purpose, excitement, and fulfillment. The ultimate performance metric might be to call people on Sunday night and ask them how they feel about going to work the next day. Are they really looking forward to Monday morning? If the answer is yes, then people can do just about anything. Sidebar, the West Point of turnarounds. Brad Cooper's initial impressions of his first day on the job were intimidating. Chain link fence, enormous coils of barbed wire, a guard at the front of the gate with a machine gun. Walking inside, he said, he was a little less intimidated. The building was so old, he said. It was like walking through the land the time forgot. I thought to myself, I can't believe I've taken this job. Cooper was the first non-political appointee to become superintendent of a local mint. He was also an experiment in Philip Diehl's change program. Once Diehl changed the law so that he could appoint whomever he wanted to leadership positions, the question was, could these people deliver? Cooper, now 38, was the test case. West Point was considered the black sheep of the mint. Everyone wondered whether it was going to shut down. But Cooper didn't shut it down. He turned it around. He became superintendent in 1996, a year in which West Point had made fewer than 638,000 American Eagle gold coins and had reject rates that were higher than 8%. Last year, it made nearly 2.8 million gold coins, along with more than 666,000 platinum coins, and had reject rates as low as 0.5%. How did Cooper change so much so fast? By applying to the West Point Mint his personal approach to minting change. Don't just do something, sit there. Cooper knew he had to unleash changes or the facility's future was in jeopardy. He also sensed a climate of fear among the 220,000 employees. So for 3 months, he just listened. He basically walked around. I met with everybody in small groups. I did nothing because I knew that if I started acting before I had built trust, any changes would fail. Sell hope, not fear. After his listening tour, Cooper had doubts about the operation's viability, but he painted a vivid picture of an upbeat future. I told people that we could radically improve our productivity, quality, and financial position. He also painted a tough picture of what might happen without change. Only huge gains could prevent reasonable minds from shutting us down. The shortest road to change isn't a straight line. Despite his patience, Cooper had a brutal first 6 months as West Point. But as his changes became performance gains, and as the takeoff in the market for gold bullion triggered big increases in West Point's production, small strides snowballed into major advances. The more we improved, the more people wanted to keep improving, Cooper says. People here were once considered the worst manufacturing organization in the mint. Now they see they can be the best. Excerpted from Fast Company magazine.